In the coming week, U.S. officials visit the Solomon Islands to discuss concerns over China. French voters choose between Macron and Le Pen in a presidential runoff. And British Prime Minister Boris Johnson travels to India. It's April 21st, 2022, in time for the world next week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, I'd like to take us to the Solomon Islands to kick things off. That's where a delegation of U.S. officials is headed this week. The visit was prompted by a new security agreement reached by the Solomon Islands and China that could strengthen China's military presence on the islands. Now, I'm not sure about most listeners, but for me, Solomon Islands used to mostly come up in terms of concerns about rising sea levels and such things. It is on the path of rising sea levels more than many other places, Jim. But there's obviously a lot more geopolitical attention being cast on the Solomon Islands these days. Can you give us a sense of what's going on?
Certainly, Bob, but perhaps we should start with a primer on the Solomon Islands. It is an archipelago of some 900 plus islands that lie about 1,200 miles northeast of Australia. The Solomon Islands has a population of roughly 650,000 people. That's about the size of Memphis, Tennessee. Most Solomon Islanders are concentrated on the six largest islands, the largest of which is the island of Guadalcanal. If that name sounds familiar, it's because it was the site of the first major land battles between the United States and its allied forces against the forces of the Empire of Japan. That was in the late summer, fall, and early winter of 1942-43. And it was really sort of a major turning point in the Pacific theater of World War II. Now, the significance geopolitically of the Solomon Islands today is the same as it was back during World War II, its location on maritime trade routes. Now, word leaked last month that the government of the Solomon Islands was negotiating a sweeping security deal with China that would give the Chinese Navy not just rights to come into Solomon Island ports, but also allow China to protect the safety of Chinese personnel in major projects, if so requested by the government of the Solomon Islands. This immediately set off alarm bells, not just in Washington, but also in Canberra and in New Zealand, about the potential of Chinese domination in that portion of the Southern Pacific, and that the Chinese would be able to control maritime routes or cut off maritime routes from Australia and New Zealand to much of the rest of the world. Now, you know, I think this may be the first time we've discussed the Solomon Islands on the World Next Week, Bob, and that's because the Solomon Islands haven't figured prominently in American foreign policy. The United States used to have an embassy in Honiara, but it shut it down back in the early 1990s. So this is not a place that senior U.S. officials normally go to, but the National Security Council Indo-Pacific Coordinator Kurt Campbell is head there. I believe he may actually be in the Solomon Islands as we speak right now. And the basic idea, as we understand it, was a effort by Kurt Campbell to try to persuade the government of Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare not to sign the deal. It's not clear whether Kurt is coming with an offer or simply a warning. Either way, it appears that he has arrived too late, as you mentioned in the intro. Sogavare announced yesterday that he had signed a deal with China. And there's some evidence that he sped up the process so he could sign it before Campbell showed up. Now, again, it's unclear what is in the signed agreement and whether it tracks with what we saw in the leaked document from last month. What's interesting is Sogavare was asked at a session of parliament yesterday to disclose the details of the agreement. He declined, saying he couldn't do so without China's permission.
So, Jim, we have not certainly talked about the Solomon Islands before in this podcast, but we certainly have fairly recently talked about the so-called AUKUS deal. We've talked about the Quad, a lot of U.S. activity in China's neighborhood. Is this sort of another move on the chessboard that we're going to see more of this type of thing going on involving China and particularly Pacific Island nations and looking at sort of the maritime routes and asserting Chinese influence?
Well, it is, Bob, and the Chinese have been working assiduously for the last several decades to cultivate relations with countries not just in the Pacific, but around the world that are of strategic value. And so what's happening right now clearly is another chapter in this growing great power competition. But it's also a story of really deep domestic division. Now, many Solomon Islanders oppose their government's move to develop close ties with Beijing. And indeed, there's a pretty strong sense among many Solomon Islanders that their government is being bought, and they have taken to the streets to make their unhappiness clear. Now, Sugiver was elected prime minister back in 2019. Once he came into office, he almost immediately broke ties with Taiwan. Now, this is what Solomon Islanders refer to as the switch. Now, there remains a lot of support in the Solomon Islands for maintaining ties with Taipei. And again, the belief is that the switch happened because a lot of Chinese mainland money was sloshing around. There certainly doesn't appear to be a lot of sympathy among Solomon Islanders for China. A poll was done last year. It found that 91% of Solomon Islanders wanted the country to work closely with democratic countries, not with China. And last November, anti-government protests erupted and turned into riots and led to a lot of destruction in the capital of Honiara, including basically destruction of a good portion of the Chinese section of the city of the Chinatown in the nation's capital. That led Australia, Fiji, New Zealand, and Papua New Guinea to all send small security forces to help quell the riots and restore order. Now, anti-China sentiment is particularly strong in the southern island of Malaita, which has maintained close relations with Taiwan and the United States. And there's a very strong sense in Malaita that the Chinese are looking, in essence, to get a beachhead in the country to use it to advance their interests. The sense there is so strong that indeed the local government on the island of Malaita doesn't allow Chinese firms to invest on the island. And again, this takes us all back to this question of whether or not the Sugiver government, if it faces renewed protests and potential riots, will use it, the new agreement, as an opportunity to bring the Chinese in to tilt the balance of power in their favor.
So any sense whether there's a blueprint that we've seen China use before in this regard, Jim? Obviously, China has been moving very strategically and very sort of assiduously on its Belt and Road initiative. But at the same time, this seems to be something a little bit different, and it seems to be also opportunistic in terms of the, as you mentioned, the leadership change being a moment of opportunity for China.
It's different in ways. Most of the Belt and Road Initiative does not explicitly refer to military arrangements. However, it is of a piece of a Chinese effort to extend their reach, to gain strategic beachheads, and to be able to build the necessary infrastructure to be able to project power. And now the Chinese will come out and say, the United States has 750 bases around the world. China has a military base in Djibouti and not much else. That you're getting ahead of yourselves. This is merely an arrangement by which Chinese Navy can come into port. And the government of the Solomon Islands has a sovereign right to choose who it wishes to make arrangements with. And Prime Minister Sugiver has talked about his desire to want to broaden the portfolio of arrangements that the Solomon Islands has with the rest of the world. And again, that leads us to the question, what is it that Kurt Campbell is putting on the table in his conversations? Is he going to take the Prime Minister up on his notion of diversifying the Solomon Islands security arrangements by saying, we too want to enter into a security arrangement with you whereby we can come and help you? And, you know, the broader, I think, context of all of this is we are, in fact, in an era of great power competition, and the great powers are going to be looking for ways to advance their interests. And then the question becomes one of, to what extent is what we are witnessing by smaller powers, them playing great powers off against one another, certainly a sovereign right to do that, to get the best deal for yourself, and to what extent are decisions being made because one power, and here clearly talking about the Chinese, they are coming into a country and buying off politicians. Now, Mr. Sogavare would deny that that is what has happened, but it is clearly what his critics have alleged has been going on for quite some time in the Solomon Islands.
And I get the sense we'll have more Pacific Island lessons coming our way, Jim.
Oh, you're certainly going to. And again, because of the strategic importance of various islands, again, what, 25% to 40% of the world trade goes through the South Pacific, Southeast Asia. Obviously, for the United States, with its security alliance with Australia and its longstanding cooperation with New Zealand, the potential that China could be able to block or interdict any maritime travel is of considerable concern in Auckland, in Canberra, and in Washington. But let's shift gears, Bob, and talk about France. I love to talk about France. And I love to talk about French politics. This Sunday, April 24th, marks the second round in the French presidential election. This is the second time in a month the French have gone to the polls. And we learned in the first round that incumbent President Emmanuel Macron was going to face off against National Assembly member Marine Le Pen. That's a rematch of their 2017 race for the Élysée Palace. Now, recent polls show that Macron holds the lead, but there are some concerns about whether the polls are in fact accurate, and also questions about who is going to show up and if enough voters of the various parties will actually cast a ballot. So walk us through what we might expect to hear after the polls close Sunday night, Bob.
Sure, Jim. We can play off of the one and only debate that was held between the two just last night. First of all, it was judged to be more substantive than the one they held in the 2017 election, which was roundly seen as a disaster for Marine Le Pen at the time. And it was Macron sort of coming out as this new figure, this new, more confident figure. And he sort of trounced her in the general election that time. This time, as you indicated, numbers are a lot closer. The first round, we should remind people, the incumbent, Mr. Macron, won almost 28% of the vote, and Marine Le Pen came in second with about 23%. That was seen as extremely close, especially since the person coming in third was the leftist candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who got something like 22%, showing a bit of a great deal of divide between left and right in France, and also some issue about who will be turning out, as you indicated, Jim, in this runoff round. How many people who had supported Jean-Luc Mélenchon, for example, are going to go ahead and vote for Macron, even though they might find him distasteful, which has been what has been voiced in some polls, but out of concern that Marine Le Pen is going to take the country too far right, everything from taking the country out of NATO's military command structure to really clamping down on immigration policies and so forth. It was the debate, I think, echoed what you had started to see more and more of, which is addressing pocketbook issues, both main candidates talking about that. But you really saw some sharp moments coming out on the question of immigration and also of Russia. And Macron came out very strongly and talked about, Marine Le Pen going to Russia as her banker, basically referring to a $10 million or so loan that her party received from a Russian-affiliated bank a few years ago, and also her past warm support of Vladimir Putin. She has sought to soften that recently in her response to the Ukraine invasion. And it's not really clear how much French voters are faulting her for her Russia affiliation over some of the other positions she holds. For example, she would ban the public wearing of headscarves, which Macron also criticized her for heavily. So you have these cultural issues. You have this sort of bread and butter issues that French voters are very interested in. You have questions of Macron's own style, which are seen as sort of an elite, almost a haughty manner among some who find him distasteful. But others who say, at the end of the day, the country is not ready to lurch to the right. You mentioned polls, Jim, and it's really important not to put too much stock in them, but it is also worth mentioning that recent days have shown polls suggesting more support for Macron over Penn. Still, by many accounts, this is going to be a much closer election than it was in 2017.
Yeah, well, certainly, again, it gets back to the turnout question. I know Mélenchon, even though he dislikes Macron's policies and ran as a sharp critic of them, came out very forcefully right after the first round to urge his supporters to vote for Macron And we will see if, in fact, that takes place. Now, the question, I think, for Macron going forward, assuming that he wins, is to what extent the mere fact that Penn will have done so well, again, if the polls hold true, is going to lead him to tilt more to the right on a variety of issues or turn more inward. Because, you know, clearly in France, as in many other countries, they're very worried about inflation, unemployment, the future for their children. Yes, there's Ukraine and what is happening there obviously has geopolitical consequences. And most French, like most Europeans, most Americans, don't wish to see Russia carry the day there. But people tend to gravitate naturally inward to the problems they're dealing with. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens in that score. And of course, if you get the upset, the surprise, that sort of could really change the course of everything that has happened over the last 2 months since the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the surprising and incredible unified Western response.
That's a really good point, Jim. It's like a lot of these elections have started playing out in terms of you have a right-oriented candidate, but also a right-oriented candidate that has a kind of populist playbook with some very appealing-sounding domestic programs that appeal toward pocketbook issues, you know, reducing taxes. This is part of the Le Pen platform, you know, maintaining 35-hour work week, reducing the price of gas, electricity, and train journeys by 5% is one of her platform items, reducing corporate taxes, and returning to a national agriculture policy. So not an EU-oriented one, but a national one that would be more favorable, seemingly, to French farmers. A 10% reduction on some of the income tax, freezing residency tax. So you have this right-of-center candidate who has already done a great deal to distance herself from other people further to her right, namely Eric Zemmour and people who might have supported her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen. But at the same time, clearly is someone who is more oriented toward rapprochement with Russia, more oriented towards tougher immigration guidelines. So more of a sort of blood and soil nationalism approach where she would, for example, withdraw from the Schengen Agreement on open borders in the EU, limit the number of legal admissions onto French territory to 10,000 per year. I think it's around the average in recent years was estimated to be in over 100,000. And other things that deal with asylum and toughening of family reunification rules. A lot of things we have seen from other right of center or farther right candidates in other democracies, Jim. And so that does raise the question, regardless of how this turns out, whether you have Macron and the result of the election moving things to the right. It's also a question of who is going to be elected in parliament. Now, French presidents have a lot of power. They can hold a lot of sway, but Macron might have to put together a cabinet of officials that hold some different viewpoints just to balance out the results of the elections, Jim. And so it's not clear how he's going to be able to govern going forward. Our colleague, Thies Matthes, has a piece up on our website talking about the governance challenges that could be facing Macron. And certainly many are looking at, you know, if we see a stunning moment like a Brexit vote or like a, you know, let's say a Trump victory from 2016, you're looking at a real lurching change in French policy and in European policy, a real jolt to the EU.
Well, you actually may, if that outcome happens, actually end up with paralysis or chaos in the French political system. You know, as you mentioned, the French have a system in which they vote for a president, then they subsequently elect a parliament. And it's not clear that Le Pen's party would do all that well in a French parliamentary election. Indeed, there's probably a pretty good chance that people who sat in the sidelines thinking that she couldn't win and they couldn't bear to vote for Macron would come out. So you could end up having a French parliament really at odds, the French president and her having an inability to actually enact much of her agenda. But I think however this turns out, I think a lot of people are going to spend time looking at her campaign and trying to draw lessons from it, because this really seems to be a case of being able to repackage what would seemingly be a very damaged candidate in a very difficult context. Again, she has the legacy of her father's overt anti-Semitism. You have a party which is very hostile to immigrants. You have a party and its leadership that has solicited financial aid from Vladimir Putin. She has spoken quite glowingly of Putin, though, in recent weeks, making mentions that she's seeing a new side of him and things to that effect. And again, given the Russian invasion, you would have thought that would have made her simply unelectable, even to get to the second round. But she nonetheless got there. And a good part of it was because she rebranded herself. You're right. Some more, in some sense, made her look less to the far right and normalized her in a way. But she also spent a lot of time visiting down and out towns and villages in France, trying to meet voters, talking about their issues, rather than running on the hot button issues that her party was known for. And I think that's one of the reasons why she's doing reasonably well in the polls. And 2022 doesn't look to be a repeat of the drubbing of 2017.
I think you're right, Jim. And it's also worth noting on the Macron side, you know, I think he was certainly widely seen as one of the Western leaders in the forefront of trying to reach out to Vladimir Putin before the invasion to head it off and to run all sorts of crisis diplomacy. Didn't yield anything major in retrospect, but he still in all put in the effort. And also was seen to have been maybe a little bit too presumptuous before the first round in terms of not campaigning as vigorously as one would have thought while Le Pen was doing her due diligence in the provinces. He has certainly stepped that up. He was at the debate and in other appearances has spoken a lot about a lot of the details about the policies that he has supported and that he would continue to support to help, you know, working French families and so forth. Obviously, the country is dealing with inflation and energy issues like a lot of other places. France does have the notable exception of being relying on nuclear power. And this is one area actually where both candidates do not differ a great deal, but they differ on so many others. It has been pointed out that if Macron does emerge with a relatively solid victory, let's say by several 4 to 5 percentage points, even while that raises concerns, you would still have this core of European nations, Germany, France, Italy, with leadership, sort of newly endorsed leadership that is pro-EU, that is aligning on the response to Russia and the transatlantic relationship. And that could be a time for a boost. So there's a lot at stake, obviously, coming up, as has been discussed in many other places, Jim, but it's really going to be fascinating what happens this weekend.
Well, European politics used to be fairly dull and plodding, and I would say over the last decade or so, European politics has been anything but.
No more. Well, there is a European politician who is going to be traveling on a closely watched trip. That would be Britain's Boris Johnson. He arrives in India actually today for the first time since he became Prime Minister, Jim. He's meeting leaders in Gujarat state today, heading tomorrow to New Delhi, where he's going to meet Prime Minister Narendra Modi. This is coming at a time of free trade negotiations between the two countries. Obviously, longstanding history, colonial history between India and the UK. Could you tell us a little bit about what Prime Minister Johnson hopes to accomplish?
Well, Bob, Prime Minister Johnson is touting the trip as an opportunity to build Britain's partnership with India across trade, investment, security and defense, and green energy. This is Johnson's first trip to India as prime minister. This is a trip that has been postponed not once, but twice already because of COVID concerns and the rest. As you mentioned, Johnson is going to begin his trip in the Indian state of Gujarat. I suspect that's no accident for two reasons. One, it happens to be the home state of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, but and this I did not know. Gujarat is the ancestral home of about half of all Britons who trace their ancestry to India. So I think when he's in the Gujarat state, Prime Minister Johnson is going to do what you do in these trips. You announce a whole new set of investment opportunities and collaborations in the rest. Not really clear how significant those various partnerships and initiatives will be. And then, of course, as you mentioned, Prime Minister Johnson and heads off to meet Prime Minister Modi in New Delhi. And there are really two big issues on the table. One's on the formal agenda, and one I suspect isn't on the formal agenda, but will come up or overshadow the talks. The one that's on the agenda is the UK-India trade negotiations. The two countries have been working on a free trade deal or free trade agreement, and their hope is they can finish an interim agreement by the end of the year. Now, again, emphasis here on interim long-term agreement. This is not going to be full-fledged free trade. All tariffs and trade barriers go away. India is a fairly protectionist state and has a well-deserved, well-earned reputation for being a very tough, very difficult negotiator when it comes to trade issues, clearly working to protect the Indian home market. Now, India is the United Kingdom's 15th largest trading partner, and the United Kingdom is India's 17th largest trading partner. So while they do have trade relations, one should not overstate the significance of trade, bilateral trade, to either country. But again, the idea is to want to grow that bilateral trade. And when you go into such trade deals, your hope is that at the end of the day, it's going to benefit your producers and exporters. And again, there'll be a lot of potential sticking points in any negotiations, questions about, you know, access of Indian manufactured goods into the British economy. Question about visas. The British in turn are going to push back and push the Indians to lower their tariff rates, which the Indians have always been reluctant to do. So this is going to be quite complicated as these things go. And again, for Modi, he's interested in getting investment that can help him fulfill his pledge to the Indian people to help India grow and absorb its population, provide good, well-paying jobs. For Prime Minister Johnson, he's trying to fulfill the promise he made to the British people about Brexit, because again, the argument there was this was going to free up Britain to go out and strike trade deals, act nimbly on the economic front in a way it couldn't under the laborious, clunky, convoluted process that the EU produced. Now, it's not at all clear that Johnson has been able to produce the benefits of Brexit that were promised, but this is part and parcel of that whole issue. The other big thing sort of hanging over these talks, obviously, is Ukraine. And it's going to hang over the conversations because Britain has been part of this very robust Western response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and India has not. Indeed, India has taken the opportunity of the invasion to cut some deals to get lower-priced Russian oil and really acting in India's narrow self-interest. Now, my friends who follow Indian politics very carefully and Indian diplomacy very carefully would say, well, the Indian government has sent a very nuanced message to Russia that it does not approve of it. And so we shouldn't say that they have endorsed the Russian invasion or that India is looking askance. But I think it's fair to say that many Western capitals are disappointed with the Indian response, at least on a rhetorical level. And the question is going to be, to what extent will Prime Minister Johnson try to push Prime Minister Modi to come out with a stronger statement condemning what the Russians have done? Now, there are certainly expectations he will do something. But other people suggest that Prime Minister Johnson has a reputation for being reluctant to criticize people to their face. And his official spokesperson has made clear that the Prime Minister has no intent to lecture India on the issue.
Well, I think that's an interesting place to start, actually, Jim, because it does speak to not only this government's style, but what is going to be British foreign policy now, the post-Brexit British foreign policy. They made a big to do about the sort of global Britain approach, which obviously trade is really important in the post-Brexit environment, but also, you know, important, compelling foreign policy, you know, issues of the moment. And a country like India ought to be, you know, sort of upholding the values of England and other major democracies. And yet, as you indicated, quite different and not only opportunistic, but really reluctant to point out the extreme abuses being committed. And that is causing a lot of concern in global chambers, UN chambers, Western governments, but also among many leading democracies. And it's this new sort of approach to democratic leadership that Modi is showing, that you've seen in people like Viktor Orban and others, where there's a balancing act, I guess, going on, but also a disinterest in sort of globally intrusive, you know, actions or statements, even at a time when we're looking at Ukraine. We'll be talking about that, I think, soon, but looking at the devastation of Ukraine, which is reaching pretty appalling levels.
It certainly has, Bob. And I do think that when we talk about Ukraine, we can certainly say that Western liberal democracies have come together with an agenda and a plan for trying to penalize the Russians and to either deter them from further action or hopefully persuade President Putin to end the invasion. But we have not, contrary to all of the rhetoric that is so frequently used, seen the world come together. I do think if you look at democracies across the so-called global South, that many of them are sitting on the sidelines, not willing to choose sides. In some sense, you've seen sort of resurgence without the name of the non-aligned sentiment you had in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
So another fascinating bit of global diplomacy to keep an eye on, Jim.
Bob, let's pivot at this time and discuss our audience figure of the week. As a reminder, listeners can vote on or tweet us their suggestions for audience figures of the week at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected as the figure of the week, 5 million Ukrainian refugees. Talk to me.
Well, Jim, we've now reached another iconic number in an incredibly short amount of time. So it's still less than 2 months that since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And we've seen a number of refugees that we have not seen in this speed in the post-World War II era. We've seen many refugees from Syria, obviously, and that still is the case. You had refugees exceeding 5 million during the Afghan war years, but again, not in this short amount of time. There's also another estimated 6 to 7 million internally displaced people in Ukraine. That number is likely to get higher as the stepped-up Russian campaign in eastern Ukraine continues. And so what you have is the humanitarian saga. You have, in terms of refugees, this cross-border surging going on and particularly affecting frontline countries, border countries like Poland, Romania, and Hungary. The United States has announced it will accept up to 100,000 Ukrainian refugees, and there's a call for the U.S. to be more specific on that. It has talked recently about trying to expedite the arrival of Ukrainian refugees in the U.S., trying to come up with a system that will allow citizens and organizations such as churches to sponsor them, sort of mimicking some episodes of large refugee influxes. But the refugee crisis is one of the multiple ones spawned by the Russian invasion. And there has been a great deal of analysis about whether all of this was part of the plan that Putin set in motion. You know, it was a refugee crisis / humanitarian crisis. It's an energy crisis the world is gripped with. There's a food crisis as well. We were hearing at the IMF World Bank meetings of a great deal of concern on that front. So no shortage of things to deal with. The international system is, you know, getting overwhelmed right now, but there have been moves. And it must be said the frontline countries to date have stepped up in some extraordinary ways to shelter and to try to take care of Ukrainians.
Bob, do we have a sense that that effort has been sufficient and that it's going to be sustained? I mean, it's obviously one thing in the early hours of a crisis to see people come together, provide aid, but this is going to go on for quite some time. And it's not clear that many of those refugees are ever going to have the chance to go back home.
That's true. Although in Ukraine's case, it has been fascinating to see in some instances, Ukrainians living in places like Poland, especially young men seeking to go back, but also families seeking to go back to Ukraine. They want to be back in the country. They want to be helping it. You've had this sense of Ukrainian nationhood that surprised many people, certainly about Vladimir Putin, but also many others, that the Ukrainian nation as such has rallied together. At the same time, the reality of the situation is many people do not want to subject their families to what they're now seeing emerge from places that had been occupied by Russia, the brutality, really the war crimes, according to many of the instances that have been reported so far in places like Bucha and soon Mariupol, which is now effectively under Russian control, although the vast steel plant there is still where up to 1,000 or so Ukrainians, both civilians and soldiers, are holed up. But to answer your question, Jim, I think the sustainability is the big issue. Poland, interestingly, even before the invasion, had been home to a large number of Ukrainian expats and has had the capacity to support them. Some of that expat community, obviously, but also having a structure in place to help. There have also been a surge of Western government aid, of NGO activity into Poland and the border regions to try to help everything from, you know, the food kitchens to agencies providing shelter, education, and so forth. You do see places like Moldova. This is a small country, one of the poorest in Europe on the border, seen as one of the most fragile countries outside of Ukraine to the events, you know, buffeting the region. What is going to be the situation there? It's not clear how much Moldova can support. Hungary, as we discussed, you know, it's got the illiberal government, newly reelected of Viktor Orban. How long will they support hundreds of thousands of refugees, for example. So that's, it's not clear, and it's also not clear how much the rest of Europe will step in terms of providing places for Ukrainians to live and to live for many years. I mentioned Afghanistan before, Jim. You've had a generation of Afghans who lived outside the country and are never going back. And some who did, you know, then have been buffeted by the return of the Taliban and so have fled again. And those numbers are swelling, and especially in the border countries of Pakistan and Iran. So we're looking at a really tough situation, and it's one that has global repercussions, Jim, and is just adding to the concerns and the burdens that the international system has at a time when it was already struggling.
Certainly the case, Bob. Can't disagree.
Well, that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. Earth Day is marked around the world. Slovenia holds parliamentary elections, and the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments on COVID-19-related immigration restrictions.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Rafaela Siewert, the pride of the NYU Violets, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Rafaela also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you very much, Rafaela, for giving Zoe a break, a much-deserved break. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch and Nicholas Martinez for their assistance. Thank you, Margaret. Thank you, Nicholas. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be careful out there.